Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It is the voice of a patriot. It is someone who's willing to speak truth to power. And of course, the part that breaks my heart is when he assures his father, it will be all right. And of course, we know it wasn't all right for him, for his twin brother, and frankly, it's not all right for the country. So the most powerful thing that you can do is exercise the franchise, whether it's vote by mail, whether it's absentee or in person, but the election of November 2020 is crucial for the future of our democracy. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I went to the Washington Monthly, and I actually saw two articles. But the one that I really want to grab first, because I think in some ways it's not that it's timely, because I feel like the whole conversation about white supremacy has been sort of erupting, and that happened even before Donald Trump. But Donald Trump has been almost like a catalyst to this conversation. And David Atkins writes for the Washington Monthly. I believe he also writes for the American Prospect and a number of other journals. But the title of his piece was, "White Supremacists are Invading American Cities to Incite a Civil War." David, I want to welcome you to the program. And your piece was horrifying. Well, not because it wasn't well written, it was incredibly well written, but because you methodically, and I mean methodically, sort of check off all the boxes that lead to the conclusion of what's happening. And in part, when you realize that Donald Trump is sort of he's kind of like a synergistic effect. All these things were there, but then Donald Trump arrived on the scene and he sort of throws kerosene on everything that's happening. And it's at the right moment because we're living through so many pandemics, a pandemic of racism, a pandemic of COVID-19, a pandemic of climate change. And in a lot of ways, it's the perfect cocktail for this kind of a situation.
Yeah, look, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on. And this has been a problem like climate change and like most of the rest of the problems, it's been a problem that's 30 years, 40 years in the making. And it creeps up on you slowly. Though activists and people who are very politically engaged have been obviously noticing, paying attention, and complaining for a long time. And you get this tension where activists who have known about these things for a long time complain and say, well, why weren't you paying attention? But the reality is it boils to, it creates a slow boil toward a crisis, like so many things do, that is now in a state of potential conflagration and wildfire erupting into political violence. And we're at a very dangerous point right now.
I've been doing talk radio since 1988. And for the first almost 20 years of my talk radio experience, it was on commercial radio. So that meant that I would listen to Rush Limbaugh. That meant that I would listen to Sean Hannity. That meant I would listen. So I have been listening to the conservatives for a long time. And I remember when I was kicked off of commercial radio because I was the wrong flavor. You know, I was someone who would sort of challenge the pharmaceutical companies and challenge the car industry and challenge the insurance companies. And of course, that's where your bread is buttered. So they would go to my station managers and say, get her off. All right. She's not good for our advertising dollars. But one of the things that really depressed me when they removed me from those stations is that I always marveled at how good they were at repetition, how good they were at telling these stories and these falsehoods and misinforming their public, but doing it with such perfection that when you realize they were on for 3 hours a day, like Rush's, 5 days a week on thousands of stations, you begin to understand why even before social media, even before the internet, it was already a toxic waste dump, those hours. Then you add social media, then you add sort of what Fox has become, and then you throw in Donald Trump. And I don't know how you fight that, because we've been too nice. Do you know what I mean? We've been so thoughtful and fact-oriented and focused, and we don't act like them. And I'm looking at what they have become, and not only have they become this, David, but they also have arsenals under their bed. They don't own a weapon. They own a weapon factory.
Yeah. I like not to dwell on that too much, because at the end of the day, no matter how many weapons a person owns, they only have two hands. Look, you're absolutely right about the right-wing media ecosystem and the right-wing infotainment complex. They use classic propaganda techniques. They use classic cult leader techniques, because they need to keep an audience within a closed information loop, an epistemic closure loop, where they don't experience any other factual sources of information, or if they do experience them, they come like a cult member, pre-inoculated to them. And that takes an extraordinary amount of effort. It takes a lot of repetition. It takes a lot of talking points. It takes discipline in the talking points. And, you know, they have managed after about 30, 40 years of this to have an audience, have a very large audience. It's not a majority of the country by any means, but it's a significant enough, maybe 20, 30% of the country, and then they get to bleed out from there, that now only consumes that type of information and is not prone to consume anything else. Combine that with the fact that they feel increasingly under threat of demographic decline and cultural loss, that they see the country that they felt like they had controlled before slipping away from them. And it can't help but trend toward alienation and violence, especially when you throw toxic religious elements into the mix.
1996, I was running for Congress, and I walked into a room in Lisbon, New Hampshire. It's a very poor town. And I walked in, and Ken has heard this story before, and I was opposing Bill Clinton on the welfare reform bill and the crime bill. And they looked at me and they said, you just support those welfare women, those women that live off the government teat. You know that storyline? The women that get food stamps and get daycare and get, you know, educational opportunities and get Section 8 housing. We hate them and we hate you. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why do you hate them? And so one of the guys said, well, you don't get it, Arnie. We work 60 and 70 hours a week. And guess what? We don't have health care. And we can't afford daycare. And our schools suck. And they went through, and we can hardly afford our property taxes. And they went through all this litany of stuff, working so hard. Yeah. And this is the thing that Democrats never got. And I'm going to sort of scold them for this. And I looked at them and I said, so tell me how taking away welfare benefits from these women get you what you need. It doesn't sound like there's something wrong with welfare. It sounds like there's something wrong with work. Because when you can work 60 and 70 hours a week and you can't provide for your families and you can't go to a doctor when you're sick and you can't provide daycare, then guess what? It ain't welfare that sucks. It's work that does. That was 1996, David.
Yep.
And we never actually fixed it.
No. You know, fixing it and having improved the social democratic, you know, safety net and wages and all the rest of these things, as of course the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is inclined to point out over and over again, would, I think, have gone a long way toward mitigating a lot of these problems. That said, of course, you're seeing from the right-wing movement happening in, say, not just developing countries like Brazil, but in many European countries as well, that even a robust social safety network does not make you immune to this sort of white wing kind of backlash. So, you know, we could have done a lot better, and I think it would have helped a lot, but it doesn't also guarantee you success against this kind of cultural revanchism. So I agree, but it, you know, that there's also the reality that there's only so much you can do against these cultural forces and right-wing propaganda.
So what do we do? Because whether Donald Trump wins or loses, they don't disappear. And frankly, in some ways, Donald wants to lose. Do you know why he wants to lose? Because he'll still be their god. He'll still be their despot. He'll still be their leader. And guess what? He can make all the money he wants. He won't have to worry about, you know, getting in the way of Congress or have something investigating him or someone looking at his tax returns. That disappears. And he still has control of a group of people who can do so many destructive things.
This question that you just answered is the fundamental question. What do you do? What do you do with the right-wing propaganda network that is poisoning people? And I just want to say as a footnote, when you combine it with the with evangelicalism and specifically white right-wing evangelicalism, you get this toxic atmosphere of unreality and refusal to accept facts and science. That leads further and further down conspiracy theory tracks. I've written before about all the different conspiracy theories you have to believe now just to be a standard Republican. Forget QAnon. Like the conspiracy theories you have to believe about climate scientists, about massive voter impersonation fraud, about just anything and everything is mind-boggling when you put it all together. So, and it's been inculcated by a right-wing media that we've heard their messages now for so many decades that we take all these things for granted without acknowledging how ludicrous it is when you put the whole belief system together. So what do you do about it? What do you do about all the people who are now enthralled to it? What do you do about the network? This question has been central to a lot of the debates that have been happening, the sort of the under table of the debates happening within the Democratic Party. What I'll call, for a simple heuristic, just broadly say Bidenism and Bernieism. It's not that simple, but we'll just keep
right,
it simple.
Right. It's fine.
Right? You know, but Bidenism being this idea that, like, if we're just reasonable and we reach out to our fellow Americans, that we can sort of bring the Republican Party and the conservative movement back from the brink through backslapping and understanding that we're all one America. And this goes back to, say, Obamaism and all the rest of it. And then you've got Bernieism that is saying, no, we can't. But, you know, if we promise populist social democracy, then we'll promise material improvements to these people's lives in a classic sort of Marxist sense. And enough of them will come over to our way of thinking that we can revolutionize the electorate and sort of disempower the right through mass solidarity. And the reality is, neither of those are likely to work.
I'm going to suggest something that might. Ready for this, David? You're going to, and I've said this before. Yeah. Climate change can go two ways. It can be the most disruptive, create migration, create war, create this. It can also be a situation where all of a sudden, because, I mean, we're looking at the fires in California. Oh, that's leftist California. But then you're looking at what happened with Laura and that hurricane that was what? Almost Hurricane 5. You know, that they'd never in 150 years seen this. And in a place that wasn't exactly, you know, a liberal blue area. And in a funny way, both the pandemic and climate change is something that, because it doesn't look at geography, because it doesn't look at your party affiliation, because it doesn't care whether you're an evangelical or you deny God, you suddenly need something beyond yourself. You suddenly need a government to be responsive, because you can't get the water back running, you can't get the electricity back running, you can't find shelter. And I'm wondering if that becomes the opportunity where, if Biden is smart, he can use this to his advantage. And that then becomes an opportunity to build an agenda that shows a proactive government, a responsive government, and a government that's there when you need it. And more people are going to need it in ways they've never even imagined before.
I agree. I think there's a lot. Reality does sometimes break through. And we're seeing that, say, with Trump's negative poll numbers, that, you know, most of his base is enthralled. But, you know, there are a significant number of people for whom reality has broken through and continues to break through. And the more you get these crises, like you said, that require collective action just by default,
right?
The more this sort of thing can break through. But the other thing that I would say, too, is I'm in California. So, you know, I'm in a state where basically the right wing has been largely disempowered. You do have sort of stochastic kind of violence and right wing upsurges that happen from time to time. But by and large, like, the Republican registration is lower than decline to state registration in California. And they held on to power for a very long time because of the requirement for a two-thirds supermajority in the legislature for Democrats to accomplish anything. But Democrats now have that. and sort of a right wing that had been completely unassailable and unwilling to move and had driven the state into budget catastrophes.
Right.
It didn't go out with a bang. It has sort of gone out with a whimper, right? As long as they hold power that's illegitimate, as long as a racist minority holds power that is illegitimate, they both feel arrogant and empowered.
Right.
But they also feel under threat and constantly with the need to engage in ever more extremist reprisals. When they lose that unearned and unjust and anti-democratic power, and then the world doesn't collapse around them. People aren't having sex with dogs. You know, the world is like, okay.
That's right.
Then it's like, oh, wait, everything's, like, it's not like California's utopia, but like everything is okay. All of these things that they thought would come to pass didn't come to pass. And so my strategy is, I was a Bernie 2016, Warren 2020 person, and in large part because
talk to Arnie and Ken. Okay, you got we're triplets. Okay, keep going.
Awesome. Yeah. Look, in large part because I do take a structuralist approach to this problem. I think that at the end of the day, if you can get rid of a lot of things that I wrote about, these anti-democratic structural ways in which they hold power and they're afraid to lose it, the filibuster, the electoral college, the gerrymandering, all of it that keeps an apartheid minority in power. If you wash that away to where they can't do that, and now they are forced to either be a permanent and regional minority or to adjust their politics to try to become more reasonable and maturitarian, and the world doesn't in fact fall down around them, I think that will be the best way of creating a long-term solution.
Okay, so since we're ideological twins, David, and I'm looking at what's the campaign, the sprint between now and November. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things have been running through my head. And that's what happened with the NBA and some of the sports teams and how all of a sudden they came out in a way that I've been waiting for years for this to happen, but for whatever happened, it finally broke. You know, Colin Kaepernick was a sort of lonely figure, and now they've all become Colin Kaepernicks. They all should wear t-shirts and say, I'm Colin too, okay? Yeah. It's just shy. But let me tell you one of the reasons why I think it's the timing of it couldn't be better. And that is that the Democrats have talked ad nauseum about African-American women, that how important African-American, and so what did Donald Trump do? And you saw it during his convention, he rolled out a lot of African-American men. And you know that there is sexism and misogyny even within the African-American community. And to a large extent, I think until the NBA actually sort of stepped forward, there Donald Trump was beginning to sort of find the sexist break even within the African-American community, because the Democratic Party never ever actually talked about African-American men. It's women ad nauseum all the time. And when you saw those teams step forward, they spoke not to the women, but they spoke to African-American men. And I thought that the timing of that was so important, because we need to bring every single human being who wants to vote and vote against Trump into the voting booth in whatever capacity. And we couldn't afford to lose African-American men. And that's exactly who Donald Trump was. They was massaging their egos that whole week. And yet what I think happened with the sports teams is that their timing couldn't be better, because they also understand what's happening with white supremacy. And I just was very, very grateful. But what I'm trying to figure out is, so what is the message to bring about the passion? Because Biden doesn't really sort of increase my pulse. But at the same time, Donald Trump frightens me beyond belief.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic point and a fantastic question. There's so many thoughts that I want to get to. I just want to mention briefly, of course, that you're absolutely right that, look, it doesn't matter what other demographic, racial or age or otherwise, Trump support among men is always higher than among women, including right. among racial minorities
exactly.
in this country.
Exactly.
And the focus of the moment demands that we pay attention to racism for obvious reasons, but it's come at the expense of a conversation around sexism, which is yes. Trump's primary appeal, I think, just as much as the racism. And it doesn't get as much conversation now as it should, but that's definitely one of the things he's going for. And we're not going to solve patriarchy in the space of 66 days until the election.
No,
but one thing that we can do and need to do is reframe traditional sort of masculine views of protecting one's family and protecting one's community and associate that with something more than just the sort of violence and domination that Trump is associated with. It's also about many other kinds of forms of protection, from wearing a mask to doing everything else. There's more to it than that. With regard to the question of what we do now, I think one of the most important points is that Trump is going to say that, like, and has been saying that this is Biden's America. This violence that we're seeing, this racial unrest, is Biden's America. And of course it isn't. It's Trump's America. And the problems with police have been exacerbated by this sort of culture war, where Trumpism is accelerating the movement of the sort of folks who tend to become police toward alienation and hatred, alienation from and hatred of the people who live in cities. You cannot have, beyond all the long pre-existing problems that you have with policing in this country and racist policing in this country, you cannot have a broadly politically alien force policing areas and cities that disagree with them at every level culturally. It's not tenable, and that is something that Donald Trump has exacerbated. So I think one of the things that Biden is doing appropriately is coming back and pointing out that no, like, all of this unrest that you're seeing is not a liberal problem, not a Democratic problem. This is a Donald Trump problem. This is a conservative movement problem. And the more these people try to send, you know, trucks of white supremacists into city centers, it feels like an invasion, because it kind of is. You have two different cultures in this country. And we have to emphasize that, look, whatever's happening in Democratic cities right now, it's a problem for Democratic cities. We can resolve that ourselves. Like, it's the addition of external forces into cities that do not respect them, do not like them, and are trying to intimidate and control them, that is the problem that's fomenting violence.
So what's the young 17-year-old who shot two people, actually she shot three people, two are dead. And I think my understanding is that the people he shot were white, by the way. One of the things that really shocked me and sort of reinforced what the problem is about this white supremacy is that we don't even know when we're a white supremacist. And that is, I'm listening to CNN, and one of the reporters on CNN was talking about this young 17-year-old boy, and he didn't even know what he was doing, and he was so confused and yada, yada, yada. And I'm thinking, if he was a young Black person carrying a weapon and was 17 years old, would she have waxed poetic about how confused he was and how he didn't really understand what he was doing? And this was, you know, he was got caught up in the emotion of the moment. And what is amazing to me is that white 17-year-olds are children and Black 17-year-olds are thugs. And even out of the mouth of that reporter, and there was a Black commentator who kind of looked at her like right away going, do you hear how you just described him? I mean, and so in a funny kind of way, we have this sort of reinforcement of the assumption of what has an excuse and what does not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, of course. And, you know, there's a viral image that's gone around and been promoted by a number of Democratic legislators, even, of cops shooting a Black man in the back seven times while a white kid, you know, with a gun surrender and walks away. You know, it's also an interesting point that you made about the fact that white people are getting, you know, that white allies are getting killed. And it's a terrible thing, because of course the whole point of all of this is that every life should matter equally. But it is an interesting phenomenon that's gone on ever since Viola Liuzzo and James Reeb were killed back in the civil rights era, that broadly speaking, white America cares more about white people being hurt than
right.
Than non-whites, and that is an awful and terrible thing. But it's a reality that when white supremacists take these sorts of violent actions against civil rights protesters,
they're race blind.
They're race blind.
They're race blind. Let's admit that's what this is. That's what this is. Whatever comes within their sight is what they shoot. Yeah. And that's another reason why I'm so excited that this movement is so marbleized, that it is Black and white, that it is old and young, that we really are seeing these things. But my concern right now is that Donald Trump has been very effective of being a president, but never being a president. And so part of the reason why he can blame this on Biden is that Biden represents government. Biden represents policy. Biden represents checks and balances. Donald Trump represents everything but that. So when he refers to Biden's America, not Trump's America, that's because Biden is government and Donald Trump is not. From the minute he was sworn in, he's never been really a president. He has been a despot. And in a funny kind of a way, it works with his base. And to some extent, it almost works with us because we don't respect him. We call him Mr. Trump. We don't even call him President Trump.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a problem, and this goes to just general social interactions. People are not judged ever in any situation, really, by some objective standard. They're judged by archetypes that we set for them. And this was one of the challenges that we had in 2016. And one of the challenges that we're having in 2020 is sort of Democrats portray themselves, and this is how you should portray yourself if you're a politician, but as a competent manager of the body politic. Like, that's the whole point of this, right? But the problem is then you get judged by that. So any little failing from competence or any little failing from perfect ethics is seen as a huge flaw because it goes against the way you've projected yourself. Whereas if you're a Berlusconi type, if you're a Trump type, if you never projected anything more for yourself than a carnival barker, no matter how much you might try to maintain equal expectations, Trump is always going to be judged against his status as a carnival barker. He's never going to be seen in this, you know, held the same sort of expectations and account, but he has to be. Like, this is the challenge for Democratic messaging, is that he is the president of the United States. He's not some carnival barker shouting from the outside. He's not up against a deep state that's still really in control. He is the executive branch of government, and he's attempting to become the sole unitary despotic power over the entire United States, and he has to be held to that.
Arnie, can I ask
a
question? So, David, I really was intrigued by your article and the discussion about the white supremacists and their coming out party, which I guess the party itself was in Charlottesville. Tell me if you think there's any possibility that they are walking hand in hand with Trump and his political cronies. You know, ICE, the deportation agency, has reached out to have citizen academies where it's basically, I think, asking vigilantes to come help us enforce the law, but they're doing it sub rosa. And then a couple of weeks later, you wind up with those Portland Vortec officers who are there with no identification on their vehicles or anything.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's all part and parcel. There have been many stories about white supremacist infiltration of these organizations and of these organizations actively welcoming people, you know, that ideology and frame of mind. And you know, you can't separate the cultural revanchism from the institutional revanchism. ICE, in terms of what ICE is designed to do, in terms of what Border Patrol is intended to do, you know, they go hand in hand. So this is part of why we have conversations about abolishing ICE and about restructuring Department of Homeland Security toward something that isn't so problematic in these areas, because it's like moths to a light. So you can try to create cultural reforms in terms of hiring practices and all that. But what you have to do is sort of reinvent what government is designed to do and what we focus on. And that's really the important.
The article at the Washington Monthly, "White Supremacists Are Invading American Cities to Incite a Civil War." David Atkins wrote this piece. It was dated August 30th. Well, posted on our Facebook page. I recommend that you read every single line. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Atkins.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. Money. Hi, this is part deux of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming on Monday afternoon. So I have known Dave Leventhal for, God, 20 or 30 years now. I've sort of followed him around the country. But now he's got a new gig and a new hat. He's now with Business Insider. He's working in their sort of newly created Washington office, covering lots of interesting things that I think a lot of people need to sort of focus on. But there's so much swirling around, David, that sometimes I think we don't even know there are other stories. All we know is that there's COVID. All we know is that there's a convention. All we know is that, you know, that we, your vote matter. And what about the USPS? So you decided to take us down a different road. And what you decided to do was write two pieces, and both of them are about the parties and their cash. Because in the end, money matters, all right? And it's fascinating because, you know, Donald Trump, when he ran in 2016, basically said that, you know, he was going to pay for his own campaign. I don't think that actually happened. And then in 2020, you know, there's no pretense anymore. He'll just take cash from anyone because, after all, that's what they expect from him. And the more money, the better. And he doesn't care whether it's from foreign sources. He doesn't care whether it's from thugs or felons. As long as the check, you know, doesn't bounce, I think he'll be really happy with it. But you wrote two pieces that sort of talked a little bit about what they say and where they go. And your piece about the Republicans was about meet the GOP's biggest Hollywood donors. And I'm thinking, Hollywood? I thought that was a den of liberals. I thought everybody there was supporting a Democratic Party. But apparently you sort of dug deep and said, well, not exactly. So one, welcome to the program. And tell me a little bit about the cash in Hollywood that's going to the GOP and Donald Trump.
Well, thank you so much, Arnie. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Hollywood, Democrats, they're hand in hand. You watch the Democratic National Convention. Who was hosting every night? It was somebody from Hollywood. It was a star. It was an actress. And of course, when you get to the money issue, Arnie, Democratic donors are just filled with Hollywood. Okay, we don't have to go chapter and verse here, but suffice it to say, there are tens of millions of dollars worth of Hollywood dollars going into the Democratic Party. Okay, so we have established that. But that doesn't mean that Hollywood isn't also deeply connected to the Republican Party. This is what this story explored. And I explored it because the Democrats, of course, they embrace Hollywood. The Republicans use Hollywood as just an absolute bludgeon. And they slam Hollywood every which way that they possibly can, particularly when they're fundraising. But Arnie, when you look, for example, at the number one super PAC, one of these organizations that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. The number one super PAC for Donald Trump is an outfit called America First Action. Well, who is its top donor? A donor who's given $6 million to the super PAC. It's a man by the name of Jeffrey Palmer, who lives in, yep, you guessed it, Beverly Hills 90210. And when you go down the list, when you look at campaign money, when you look at lobbying, when you look at the type of support that that Hollywood is getting from Republicans too, you add it all up, and man, the Hollywood Hills are definitely filled with not just the letters on the Hollywood sign, but also GOP as well.
Well, but they remember, what is the story? Right after Donald Trump basically signed the tax cut bill, he went back down, I guess, Mar-a-Lago, one of the Trump properties, and, you know, he sat down at the table and looked at the very wealthy people sitting at the table going, "You owe me. I just delivered huge chunks of cash for you with that tax cut." So to a large extent, I almost feel like these people in Hollywood and Beverly Hills and Palm Beach and all these sort of wealthy places that he rails about, he actually bought them. He bought them because he said, look, I gave you an enormous tax cut. All I'm asking for is, like, give me like a third. You know, it's like this is, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. And he kind of even admitted it when he was at that dinner. You know, I just made you really rich. And so I think to a large extent, he feels like they owe him. And I think to some extent, they don't only owe him, they want more of the same. So this is one of the wisest investments they could make. They don't care whether he bashes them. This isn't about them. This is about their portfolios. And he has been the best thing for their portfolios. So, you know, rail away. You know, those are, what is it, sticks and stones may break my bones, or words will never harm me. And frankly, what they've got is they've got the words, but they also have the cash.
And when the Motion Picture Association of America decided to hire a lobbying team for this past year, Who did it make sure it had on its lobbying team? A man by the name of Brian Ballard. Well, who's Brian Ballard? Brian Ballard is not only a lobbyist, a very successful one in his own right, but also one of the top Trump campaign fundraisers of the past several years. He is so connected to Donald Trump that you got to put him in the upper echelon of people who have access to the White House, have access to the president, have the ear of the Trump administration. And so, yeah, when the Motion Picture Association of America wanted to lobby, for example, on COVID-related legislation, well, Brian Ballard was their guy doing that. And so money is a huge motivating factor for many of the special interests that are connected to Hollywood, without question, Arnie. And kind of the flip side of that coin, too, is it's not like Donald Trump isn't all Hollywood himself. I mean, Donald Trump has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I forgot that until you wrote that. I completely forgot that. That's hilarious.
I mean, he's been in movies left and right. I mean, from like The Little Rascals to Zoolander. He's been in Sex and the City. He's been on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He's been on Saturday Night Live. He had his own show on NBC for more than a decade, The Apprentice. So this is somebody also too, I should mention, for you wrestling fans out there, Donald Trump is in the World Wrestling Entertainment Hall of Fame by virtue of his memorable appearances on WWE shows. So, you know, this is somebody in Donald Trump who has for decades embraced Hollywood, even at the same time while slamming it. So like a lot of things, Donald Trump is very good at kind of working both ends of the spectrum, talking about things in contradictory terms. And Hollywood, hating it and loving it at the same time is just a sort of the same kind of thing in a different way, if you will.
Well, so, I mean, it fits in with the no platform platform. I mean, in a lot of ways, he's your Rorschach test. You know, when you find out this information, he can sort of, you know, skirt around it and then he can bash it at the same time because the fact that there's conflict is actually something he loves. Well, you know, if he's inconsistent, that's his consistency. His consistency is his inconsistency. I mean, in a way, you have to marvel at what he does. But I'm kind of curious, as you were doing this piece about Hollywood and, you know, the movie industry, entertainment has to really hate Donald Trump because he hasn't been good on the pandemic. And I am trying to figure out how, well, you can get a tax cut, but if you get a tax cut on a movie that you can't make because no one's going to the movies, what good is a tax cut? If you're an entertainer and nobody's showing up in venues so they can buy tickets at, you know, $200 a ticket because they can't show up because of the pandemic, at what point in time does an affinity for Donald Trump actually hurt what you do? When do they start doing the cost-benefit analysis that you love the cash, but if you're not making the cash, a tax cut really doesn't send you anywhere?
And that's why the Hollywood lobby, the motion picture lobby, for example, is very bipartisan in the staff that it has. It's not just filled with Democrats, not just filled with liberals. It has plenty of Republicans on it, plenty of people who've worked for all different members of Congress who are Republicans, say nothing of the one gentleman, Brian Ballard, who we mentioned before. So yeah, it's all about the bottom line. They want to make sure they're going to make money. Now they're not going to be able to lobby COVID-19 away, but they are going to try to do everything in their power when you have Congress debating pieces of legislation that are measured not in the millions, not in the billions, but in the trillions of dollars. Yeah. To make sure that you've got a seat at the table and that your interests are going to be represented to the strongest, greatest degree that you can possibly have them represented. So yeah. That's been happening. That will continue to happen. And you're probably going to have, I would bet, can't predict the future, Arnie, but I would imagine that, you know, they're going to have more Republicans coming on their lobbying staff than they had before. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, who loves talking about how he donates his $400,000 presidential salary every year to different government agencies to fund them. A nugget that we detail in the story, Arnie, he's still receiving, Donald Trump, this is, a Screen Actors Guild pension for all those movies that he used to be in. And that's numbered, you know, about $100,000 close there too, every single year. So that's money in Donald Trump's pocket.
All right. So now,
can I ask David a question?
Of course.
You were talking about how Hollywood, how Trump plays both sides, how Hollywood is willing to play both sides, giving money to Democrats and Republicans. And it made me think that isn't that the same story that we've been saying about all of Wall Street, all of big business, you know, yeah. the Wall Street donors,
pharma, insurance,
want Democratic politicians, whoever wins, they want the winner to enact legislation and policies that serve their financial interests.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's an incredibly good point that I think is oftentimes lost in sort of the binary of, oh, you must be a conservative, or you must be a liberal, you must be a Democrat, or you must be a Republican. Now, you know, when it comes to a lot of special interests that are motivated by profit, they want to make money, then they're going to do what is ever necessary for them to play the political game, play the game of politics here in Washington, D.C. So, and that oftentimes means, if not going 50-50 in their campaign contributions or the way that they lobby, pretty darn close. And all of the different industries that you just mentioned, you can absolutely put them in that category, Ken.
So the only way that we're going to deal with special interests, Ken, is that we're going to have to do significant campaign finance reform. Because as long as you can buy in, and that's exactly what they're doing, the insurance companies buy in. I mean, I'm listening to an ad by Donald Trump talking about Joe Biden and Big Pharma. I'm like, I'm barfing, okay? Like he's bought by Big Pharma. He's bought by Big Insurance. And I'm going, really? But yet at the same time, your point in your second story is Biden's dark side, how Democrats are embracing secret money and the Citizens United decision to defeat Donald Trump. So as I'm trying to think, oh, Donald, what are you talking about? I'm kind of curious, what does Biden say, but what does Biden do?
Well, Joe Biden, as was the case with Hillary Clinton, as was the case with Barack Obama before her, as has been the case for Democrats pretty much writ large for the better part of the past two decades, have been stridently against secret money in politics, stridently against big money in politics. This particular story, we focus on the first half of that, which is the secret money that's coming into politics. And the bottom line that we found in our analysis is that Joe Biden has benefited from more than $50 million worth of money that you can't trace back to a human source. We just simply don't know where it's come from. And so on one hand, although Joe Biden, if you read his platform, if you read the Democratic National Convention's overall platform for 2020, you know, it would read to most people as if dark money is the worst thing in the world and that Democrats don't touch it in any way, shape, or form. That's just simply not true. Now, the argument, which is made by many Democrats, including many Democrats that I talked to for this story, is that, look, we have to be pragmatic about this. We are going up against Donald Trump. There's a much greater evil in their opinion than the notion of secret money in politics, and they got to get Trump out of office. And then after they do, they will go and they will pass legislation in a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic White House to fix this, to cure the ill, to fix this wrong. But I talked to plenty of other Democrats who said that's nonsense and that Democrats need to hold themselves to a higher standard. Joe Biden is not. And in the name of expediency, Joe Biden is doing the wrong thing. That's the internal argument that you're hearing when you talk to folks in the Democratic
Party. All right, so let me mention
that there was a Democrat elected president in 2008 with Democratic House and Democratic Senate. And
Thank you. I was just going to say that, Ken. We're on the same page.
And a point that was not lost on plenty of the folks who I talked to, and including some Republicans who I talked to, who said, yeah, okay, Democrats can talk as strong a game as they want to, but look, they were doing the same thing about a decade ago. They had the House, they had the Senate, they had the White House, and they didn't do anything. So, hey, Democrats, you can believe that, but it might be a whole bunch of BS. So it's going to be, if Joe Biden wins the White House, this will be a very, very most curious debate as to whether the Democrats are truly going to make this a priority or if it's just going to be a lot of talk.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned in your article that already he has 8 times the amount of dark money the pro-Hillary Clinton super PACs took in during the 2016 presidential campaign. 8 times? That's a lot of money.
And counting. And so what's happening, Arnie, in brief, is that this time around, there's a couple of nonprofit organizations in particular, and nonprofit organizations of a certain sort, they're called social welfare organizations, they can raise as much money as they want to, and they don't have to disclose who their donors are. But thanks to the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court 10 years ago, These types of nonprofits, as they raise that unlimited money, can also spend a significant portion of it on politics, okay? Now, they've gotten tricky, okay? And what they're doing is that they're taking-
I'm shocked. They've gotten tricky, huh?
I know. it should you know, just shock everyone. But they're taking this secret money that they don't have to disclose, and they're giving some of that money to super PACs. And super PACs are, by their nature, political organizations that do have to disclose their donors. But here's the twist. Super PACs only have to disclose the fact that they're receiving the money from the nonprofit. So if it's you, if it's me, if it's George Soros, if it's you know, Lord God in heaven, who, it doesn't matter. Okay. We're never going to know who that is, who's making the donation, the initial donation to the nonprofit. I focus in the story on a group called the 1630 Fund, which is one of these social welfare nonprofit corporations based in Washington, D.C. And they just flat up refuse to say who is funding them. And yet they're giving tens of millions of dollars and pumping that money into Democratic super PACs that are directly advocating for the support and election of Joe Biden and against the election of Donald Trump. And people may be very happy about that on the Democratic side. But if you ask the question, all right, where is that money really coming from? Nobody will give you an answer. And you can't find the answer out because it's not knowable under the current law of our country as it stands right now.
So you have a line in here. This is kind of interesting. Unite the country. The super PAC that created the advertisement lauding Biden has disclosed the names and locations of most of its 2020 election donors. But its single largest contribution, $3.5 million on June 30th, doesn't come from a specific person. And I think that's exactly what you were referring to.
Precisely.
Is that once again, even so, I guess here's the dilemma. When they had the opportunity, they didn't. It's an addiction. It's an addiction because in the end, they want to maintain their power. And right now, the Democrats are, let's be honest, they're worried about the progressive base because a lot of people who've been there for 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years are suddenly finding out that they can lose a primary. They can lose a primary, and that has never occurred to them. What I think is fascinating about this money and politics things is that it may work really well in a general election. I'm not sure money and politics works really well in a primary, at least in a Democratic primary. I think given the fact that you're running against sort of the centrist versus the progressive, in a lot of ways, the more money the centrist has, the more vulnerable they are if they're running against a progressive. I think I'm looking at the Kennedy race in a funny way, the right. Kennedy-Markey race. And while Markey has been there forever, he's kind of running as like, you know, an old AOC. and Kennedy is running as, you know, the guy with more cash that you could possibly, you know, throw a stick at. And he's losing. I mean, he's losing by some significant numbers. We don't know until the actual vote happens. But it's kind of interesting to see how the money story doesn't play out well in a primary, at least for Democrats, but it plays out really well, or at least they can talk themselves into it in a general election.
And at least a couple of people who I talked to said, you know, this would be an opportunity at the national level, at the presidential level, for Democrats. And again, these are just, you know, part of the debate that's going on. But their point is that if the Democrats were to use this to their advantage and reject certain types of money, that would actually be a selling point. And I think what you picked up in the primary conversation here, Arnie, is that sometimes that is a selling point. I think you can look at Bernie Sanders, for example, and suggest or theorize that he overperformed in 2016 and perhaps even overperformed in 2020 because he was willing to say, look, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm going to go full on and I'm going to reject support from super PACs. And he did to a pretty strong degree. And I'm not gonna take all
Warren,
this kind of money.
I think,
I'm gonna be a clean
correct?
Candidate.
And I think Elizabeth Warren did the same thing.
Yeah, to a large degree. In a way, the Democrats were trying to, like, you know, out anti-money each other in the primary. And it was like, oh, you know, I'm not going to take oil money. I'm not going to take, no, I'm not going to take oil money and lobbyist money and super PACs are bad and dark money was bad. And it worked, you know, for a while, or they saw it as a competitive advantage. But that all kind of goes out the window, Arnie, once you get to a general election. And, you know, Donald Trump is doing whatever he wants to, no holds barred. And Republicans make no apology about that. They say, look, you know, these are the rules, and we see money as free speech. I mean, you can agree with that or violently disagree with it, but that's what they believe. And the Democrats are kind of getting hung up a little bit more about some of these issues.
Let me just say something. I'm gonna do a little bit of pushback. I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but I'm going to say it out loud. I think there is virtue in the primary when it isn't about money, that it's about policy and ideas. But I think when you enter into the general election and you're running against people like a Donald Trump, mm-hmm. who will basically whore himself out for anyone. I mean, whether it's foreign money, whether it's felon money, he doesn't care. As long as the cash, as I said before, as long as the check doesn't bounce, he'll take the cash. And when you're in that situation with someone who is a perpetual liar, who's someone who will take any kind of money, who will spend it in any kind of way, who will twist any law to the point where you're not even sure it's still the law that he's sort of following, I am not sure that Joe Biden should run like, you know, a nun, you know, and that his purity will be successful because he's not being pure with someone who at least understands why there's a rationale for purity. He's running against someone who basically will do anything and absolutely anything and take any money and spend any amount of money in order to win. Does it make sense for you to sort of maintain your virtue there because you're in such a different kind of a race?
Well, you should have a conversation with Steve Israel, Arnie, the former New York congressman who a long time congressman, he was the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He and I'm paraphrasing my story here, but he said effectively, look, if you want to get Donald Trump out of office, if you want to remove him from the White House, you've got to push every single button that you can, use every tool, use every weapon, and worry about reform after you come into office. So that is a overriding feeling on the Democratic side right now that, yeah, okay, it's great. We can talk philosophically. We can talk about what we want to be the case. But in this moment, when Donald Trump is doing whatever Donald Trump is going to do, and Republicans are being absolutely positively cutthroat in every way, shape, or form, the Democrats have to fight just as hard. And if they got to get a little dirty, well, they got to get a little dirty.
Did the Democrats say the same thing in 2018 when they wanted to take back the House? And didn't they say the same thing in 2018 when Hillary was running against the horrible Donald Trump? And, you know, basically, haven't they said the same thing all the time? And so, again,
it worked in 2018, Ken. In 2018,
they get elected now, they're going to do anything different.
But it worked in 2018. In 2018, they won. They took back the House.
Yeah, but they didn't get dark money out of politics.
Right. Well, so what you're saying is they didn't get dark money out of politics, but they were still successful. In the primary, the progressives used the money argument, but when they got into the general and the general, they didn't use the money argument. And look what you saw in the way of the result. I am not supporting this. I am angry that when they had control, they did nothing. They talk a game, but they don't deliver. That is absolutely the case. So I got to ask Dave Leventhal one more thing. Since you're down in D.C., and one of I think the most effective groups against Donald Trump is actually not Democrats. It's the Lincoln Project. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about what kind of money we're talking about with the Lincoln Project and where this money is coming from? Is this money that I could sort of follow? Do I get to know which Republicans are writing the checks or which companies? Or are they also finding these sort of organizations that are sort of opaque to fund the Lincoln Project so that the Lincoln Project can do lethal things so that Joe Biden doesn't have to be as lethal?
Well, the Lincoln Project is really, I don't know if you can call them a full-on anomaly in politics, but basically have a bunch of disgruntled anti-Trump Republicans who have formed this group and they're acting in some ways in as aggressive and even perhaps more effective manner than Democratic super PACs would be doing. Now, it's all about getting Donald Trump out of office. They are nominally pro-Joe Biden in that respect, but they take a little bit of dark money, but most of it is transparent. They're a super PAC. And I think if you go to opensecrets.org to plug them, they've got a great page on the Lincoln Project that will list all of their donors. You can also go to fec.gov and look at the Lincoln Project's donors there as well. They take a lot of smaller dollar donations, and they've been effective in addition to taking some big dollar donations at getting sort of that grassroots energy that a lot of Democratic super PACs just simply don't have, because the Democratic super PACs are are kind of working for the big dollars. So they're a very, very fascinating group. And George Conway, although he's taken a leave of absence from them.
Yeah, for family reasons, is
one of the head honchos over there, along with a bunch of other notable kind of A or B list Republicans of yesteryear who've gathered together to really just try to knock Donald Trump off of his address at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
So I talked to a Never Trumper the other day, and we were talking about the Lincoln Project. And one of the things he said I thought, which was so fascinating, he said, there is virtue in having your name on there. You don't want to be, you want to be transparent. Because the reason you are doing this is that you are assuming that you can use your sphere of influence. That if people see your name, people know who you are. You have a history in your community, or you have a history in your industry, or you have a history in whatever. It is to your benefit for people to know that you have contributed to the Lincoln Project. Because you are putting your money where your politics at this moment are, and what your vision for the future of the country is, and that there's no value in hiding it and doing it in a dark manner. The real value is not only that these ads are very honest, they're very factual, they're very lethal, but they're also very transparent, and they want to be transparent with that money because it sort of, to some extent, it adds to the integrity of their work. Does that make sense? Okay, go on, David.
Well, I think you would find a lot of people who agree, and that's kind of been their mode of operation. It's not a bunch of nameless, faceless Republicans. I mean, you go to their webpage, and the whole gang is there, and they're very open and transparent about it. And also, too, as I said before, pretty open and transparent about their donations. And I'm looking at their list right now. They have one contributor who has given $1 million, and they have several who've given six figures, a bunch who've given five figures, but a lot of the contributions that they have are measured in, you know, four, three, or two figures. So it's definitely been an effort to get a whole lot of people behind it, that they're going to be open and proud about it. And even if that takes slings and arrows from the President of the United States, who is obviously not too crazy about this group.
All right, Dave Leventhal is now writing for the Business Insider. He wrote two pieces about money in politics, the Republicans sleeping with Hollywood, oh my God, and Joe Biden taking something called dark money. Oh well, but you know what? This is not a time to be a purist. I read that quote. Dave Leventhal, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, Arnie. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. Just now.